Hey everybody, welcome to Book Talk. I'm Ryan Van Winkle, your host for this episode. We have a lot of different voices for you today, and even a little bit of music. This is really an exciting episode because we've got three great people on here. Later on in the podcast, you're going to get to hear from Naomi Alderman. She was recently at the Edinburgh International Book Festival speaking with Margaret Atwood about playing with literary form and engaging with different platforms. And she's going to do that at the end of the podcast. You'll hear exactly what I'm talking about soon. We also have Pippa Goldschmidt, who's written a brilliant science-based novel about astronomy, and she shoots us out into space. But it's also got a really human center to the book, which is fantastic. And first, we're going to start the podcast with Helen Fitzgerald. She's a wonderful writer. She, as you'll hear, she puts her characters in really difficult, I think we say in the interview, nightmarish situations. And she's got a great sense of humor about doing that to people. Well, fictional people, not real people. So to start the podcast, we sat down with Helen Fitzgerald. She's got a new book coming out in September. You must check it out. I'm sure you'll want to after listening to her describe it. Here she is, Helen Fitzgerald.
Helen Fitzgerald. In terms of my work in general, I think it's been difficult for people to kind of classify it. So, yeah, I have been called psychological thriller. I've been called chick noir, tartan noir, all sorts of different things. And I'm kind of proud of that. I like the fact that it's hard to classify. The next book that is coming out is with Faber and Faber, and that's in September, the next adult one. And it's about a couple who, on the long-haul flight to Australia with their little baby, they're made to change their medications at airport security into clear bottles, because they're more than 100 mils. So they've got paracetamol for the baby and antibiotics for her. I've done the long-haul flight to Australia with a baby, and I know how horrific it is. And for them, it's the same. The baby cries the whole time. And unbeknownst to each other, they both end up giving him a dose of what they think is Calpol. And when they're driving to Geelong from Melbourne, once they've arrived, they realise that the baby is dead and that they've accidentally overdosed him. So it's about a couple, really, who make a terrible decision. And the theme of it really is about a dysfunctional couple who are the kind of people who do make bad decisions together. And they cover this up as a kidnapping. But, I mean, I'd never overdosed my children, but I know that on these flights, you do try to do everything that you can to calm down your baby. You're in this bubble with where people absolutely hate you if your child is crying. And now I'm one of those older women who hate these babies who cry and really get annoyed if you find, oh my God, there's a child right in the seat next to me and this is going to be a nightmare 21 hours the flight is, you know. So I really felt for her and probably wrote a scene, the longest scene I've ever written in one place, which was this woman on this plane going through absolute hell where her husband is somehow able to sleep and has three books which he figures he'll be able to read, and she's, you know, she knows that's not going to happen for her. She doesn't even get to eat or go to the toilet, you know. So it's a nightmarish situation, and it is a serious book. I mean, I wasn't trying not to be funny. In a lot of my books, I just naturally do have humour in them. It wasn't really possible to have a lot of it in this. It's a very serious situation from the very beginning. And as it unfolds, it's really about the, as I said, the dysfunctionality of this couple.
So, I mean, that's an incredible premise. You also have a book called The Donor, which again has an incredible premise. Do you want to just quickly sum it up for people?
The Donor is about a father who has two daughters. They're twins and they're 16 years old. And when they're 16, they're diagnosed with kidney disease and they both need a transplant. It's not curable. They will die if they don't get a transplant. As we know, the waiting lists on the NHS are very long, so the chances of these girls, one or both of them, dying is high. He's a single father. He has to find a way to save his daughters, basically has to find a way to get two kidneys. So it's about his journey of all the different possibilities that he has in order to save them.
Or just to choose one.
Or to choose one, which is obviously one of his options, the very last option, and the most horrific option.
This is a horrible horrible situation you've put your characters in. Does it start for you in that horrible situation, or does it start more out of like an environment where you're on a plane just thinking, God, these kids are killing me?
It starts with a horrible situation. So with The Donor, I thought, wouldn't it be awful if you had to choose? And I knew someone in a family who had a similar situation to that, where there weren't enough healthy kidneys to go around. And with The Cry, it started with, my God, imagine if you accidentally overdosed your baby. With this couple, he has a child who's 10 from a previous relationship who's being neglected, he thinks, by the mother, and he's going to fight for custody of her. So his reasoning isn't bad, actually. He doesn't want to go to jail. He doesn't want to be in trouble and lose his other daughter as well. So his reasoning, his logic is actually okay as to why they cover it up. So, yeah, it always starts with the horrible situation and then I work from there.
In both these premises as well, kind of stuff you wouldn't necessarily expect to find some humor in, but how conscious are you of that? Do you ever feel the need to pull it back or do you just let it ride? Do you just let the kind of pathos of the situation kind of continue on, carry through the book, regardless of the subject matter? Or do you ever have to say, no, I can't. I'm smirking. I can't do this here.
I never try to be funny, and I don't particularly think, I mean, we're not laughing a lot here, are we, Ryan? But no, I never try to be. It's just that I'm drawn to people who are funny, and even in difficult situations, they're funny. You know, my family, some of the most funny people. I think my dad was particularly very funny. And whenever something difficult was happening, even a death, we would always be laughing as well. And not at the death, just because, you know, we'd be needing that release and enjoying that release. I love people who can laugh, and I'm drawn to people who can and want to laugh. And so naturally, I'm drawn to writing characters like that too.
And I guess on one hand, like, these are incredibly difficult situations, but on the other hand, you look at them from the right angle, which we're all capable of at certain times, even in our own misery, going, this is absolutely, this is so ridiculous and humiliating. You have to laugh.
I mean, whenever I read or hear something awful, whether it be a personal story of someone I know, I think, well, that's made me feel sick. Well, that therefore is something that I will want to write about. I don't like writing stories where people are in, you know, boring situations and not doing very much. I like writing stories about really interesting situations which make you feel either sad, happy, sick, as long as you feel something.
You had a really interesting work life before you started writing novels. You worked with horrible men.
I gave it up 4 years ago. I was working as a criminal justice social worker, initially in the community, which was very exciting, and you're out there visiting people and you're supervising probation and parole, basically, and writing reports for the court. Then I worked in Barlinnie for 2.5 years, and I left to write full-time. And in those 4 years that I've written full-time, I've slowly gone crazy, because living in my own head, talking about myself and nothing else, thinking only my own thoughts, I don't think is good for me. I think there are people who can do it, but I'm going back to work part-time in criminal justice.
Are you ready for it? Because I was reading just this interview with you in The Guardian from, 2009? It sounded terrifying at times and really I mean, I know from people who have done that work and doing, you know, I've never worked in prisons, but doing some of the work in social work as well, it's exhausting and it takes a toll on you. And then to add into the complications of, you know, sexual abuse and assault, murder, and the kind of justifications of it that happen when you're intimate with people, It sounds very draining.
I think my last job in Barlinnie was particularly because it was either very quiet and very slow, or it was madly stressful, and it was also mostly sex offenders, and I didn't enjoy working mostly with sex offenders. This in the community will be all those things. It is draining and exhausting and taxing, but I really miss it. Actually, it took me a while to realise that I do miss it, but I do, and I need it. I need to have that part of my brain working again. I'm dying to listen to other people's stories and not just make them up myself, you know, and listen to my own thoughts, because that can be a recipe for madness, I think.
Do you think the part of that work comes out in sort of this empathetic way that I guess you have, which in terms of just really taking a situation and really understanding how people could make the worst decisions or bad decisions, but actually logically think they're quite good?
Yeah, absolutely. What I think the biggest skill you have to have as a writer and as a criminal justice social worker is empathy, is an ability to not write someone off because they've behaved badly, made a bad decision, to look at why that happened and to understand it. And my work has informed that always. I've always wanted to understand the offender. And usually the main character in my books is the offender.
Yeah, so that's like the first person drive of the cry would be from the parents' perspective. Yeah. and why they're doing these things that, you know, you like to believe in a different situation you'd behave differently, but, you know, you kind of paint yourself into a corner, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. I wrote the cry, initially I was going to just do it from the mother's point of view, and after about 100 pages I was so exhausted being inside her head, and I felt so sorry for her. You know, she just made this most terrible mistake and then decision on top of it, which, you know, just snowballs and snowballs in into lie after lie after lie. And eventually I thought, I have to get into another character's head or, you know, I won't survive writing this book. So I also wrote from the point of view of the ex-wife, which was just a bit of relief for me, you know.
Not even necessarily for the just giving Helen a break.
Yeah, for the reader too, because a couple of people read the first 100 pages and said, oh my God, you know, I think if you don't change point of view, I'm going to have to stop reading. I mean, I think it really works, but it is so grueling and upsetting. And I don't think I would have wanted to read on either unless I'd had some other kind of something else going on in someone's head.
Speaking of reading things, I was wondering if we could maybe get a little top five list. I asked you to put together a list of books which your fans or fans of crime writing, crime fiction, might like, but that are not crime fiction.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I suppose, you know, I think to myself, this is the kind of thing, if you've read, then you might like The Cry, which is a brilliant book. So I just read Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn. Everyone else in the world has read it as well. It's very, very successful, and it's brilliant. It's brilliant. I love the interesting female character, the badass woman who's flawed but believable and somebody I would want to be friends with and who makes terrible decisions like I do sometimes. I love Lisa O'Donnell, The Death of Bees, and she's got another book coming out this year. I don't know what it's called, but she's just got the freshest voice, the most original voice I've heard or read in years. She's from Glasgow, but she lives in LA now, and she's doing really, really well. I just read one that's called The Silent Wife by A.S.A. Harrison. And again, that's a very interesting female character about a dysfunctional relationship, which is actually written from the point of view of the female and the male, which was really tempting for me to do. I thought after finishing The Cry that I could actually write the whole book again, but from the perspective of the husband, who, you know, really didn't get a fair say in my book, I have to say. Another writer who is actually a friend of mine, but I just love his stuff, is Doug Johnson, and he's got a book called Gone Again. And he is unpretentious, writes believable characters. And I think he writes stuff that's pretty close to the sort of stuff that I write too. Another one I've put there is a very big guy, but I've put Peter Carey's Illiwacka because it's set in Geelong in Australia, which is where my book is set. And I love Peter Carey, but I love this particularly because of the landscape and the way that he was writing about a place that was so familiar to me. My family live down that way. So those are the five.
Helen Fitzgerald, everybody. You can find her book, The Cry, very, very soon. It's out from Faber and Faber, and it's a fantastic piece of writing. She was at the Edinburgh International Book Festival, and so was Pippa Goldschmidt, our next guest. And she was the recipient of a Scottish Book Trust New Writers Award, and we're absolutely delighted because this is her first book. We're really pleased to feature her on the podcast. So here we are with Pippa Goldschmidt.
I'm Pippa Goldschmidt, and I'm the author of The Falling Sky, which has just been published by Freight Books. The book is about a young astronomer called Jeanette, who is very ambitious and keen to get ahead in her chosen profession. And she accidentally makes an interesting discovery about distant galaxies that seems to challenge the basic theory of the universe, the Big Bang theory. And at first she's really excited by this because she sees this as a way to get ahead and a way to get a better job. And then she gradually realizes through the course of the book that by challenging the Big Bang theory, she challenges her sense of place in the universe, and her sense of her own personality, if you like, is predicated on clear-cut scientific theories. And not only that, she begins to be cast back to her childhood and the tragic events with her sister dying, which she never fully understood. So she has to go back and understand what happened in her childhood and understand fully what it means to be uncertain in the universe by the end of the book. There is comedy in it. I was pretty keen for it not to be too heavy. There is some science in it. There's some cosmology. And obviously in discussing the sort of tragic events of her childhood, that's not very happy stuff either. But I was quite keen to show the more sort of ludicrous aspects of being a young academic and how you have to interact with the interesting characters that you can find in academia, shall we say.
Yeah, I guess there is. And you've spent a lot of time in academia. You were an astrophysicist. physicist. Yes, is that true?
That's right. Yeah, so the book is partly based on my own experiences. I did a PhD in astronomy at Edinburgh at the Royal Observatory, and then I worked as a postdoc for several years at Imperial College. So I drew upon my own love of the science, but also my huge frustration at what it actually means to be a junior academic and what you have to do to get ahead, and some of the sort of less appealing aspects of that life.
Do you think that that's a microcosm of like regular academia or regular work life in any way? Or is it so far out that like actually you get a certain kind of character taking part in that field?
I think it's quite odd, actually. I think that's right. I think it's fairly typical of a lot of workplaces. The bizarre thing about working as an astronomer is that you're dealing with the universe itself. So you're writing equations that deal with the birth and creation of the universe. You're looking at images of distant galaxies, but you're still having arguments with the bloke next door about computing and stuff like that. So
put your shoes on when you're at work, sir.
Well, I'm a bit guilty of that myself, but but yeah, so you get all that pettiness kind of amplified by the fact that by the sort of bizarre subject matter that you're actually talking about.
Yeah, tell me about the Big Bang, because you know, I guess I thought it was a great idea, because that's something we kind of all kind of understand. You know, you don't have to be a science expert to know the Big Bang. Everybody knows the Big Bang.
She's very careful not to absolutely refute it. She makes this discovery that she thinks challenges it, but she tries to stay neutral about it because, as she argues herself, it's such a beautiful theory. I was keen to write about the Big Bang theory, like you said, because it's something that everyone knows a little bit about. So it's instantly recognizable. It's not so, it's not in its basic concept. It's actually quite easy to explain. Yeah, exactly. It explodes, things start, things evolve, you know, galaxies evolve and all the rest of it. So I was keen to use a bit of science that people could latch onto quite straightforwardly. And the science in the book that kind of develops from that to do with galaxies is very visual, and the visual aspect of astronomy is something I was very keen to get across, and that's kind of reinforced by discussions of visual art in the book too. One of the main characters is an artist, so the way that we see the universe around us, and the way that we understand what we see, and then the way that we see other people and images of them is one of the sort of central tropes of the book.
So that, the way we see people.
Yeah, the way that we try and understand people from what we see of their behavior, their interaction with us, their kind of external interaction with us, and also the way that we picture people around us in terms of photography and visual arts was quite important to the book, and how we can use those as sort of aids of to understand. We can use those to understand other people in a sense. In the same, you know, if you paint a portrait of someone, you think it's showing you something of their essential aspect, their essential personality. And that's quite a key idea in the book. Jeanette has her portrait painted by a friend of hers, and what happens as a result of that is central to the book. And I was keen to develop that, and because Jeanette fatally misunderstands what's going on as part of that process, and I was keen to explore that.
Your idea of things is not necessarily the entire thing.
Right, and it can be misinterpreted by different people. Different people will have different interpretations of a portrait. Different scientists will have different interpretations of a visual image of the sky. Mm. These things are not always easy to read.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting kind of dichotomy. And the fact that you're using both artists and scientists to kind of put this idea forward is really interesting. That must be kind of like both aspects of your own personality. There's no one essential Pippa the astrophysicist or Pippa the author. It's you're the full thing. Did you feel like you were breaking yourself in half in terms of?
Not really. I didn't really feel myself sort of breaking in half. It was more exploring different facets, different, like exactly what you said. Art and science are complementary ways of understanding the world around us, and they can fit together very nicely, or they can not fit together. So I was keen just to sort of explore those different ways, really.
It would be nice right now, before we go, let's have a little sample of the book. Maybe just start at the beginning, give people a little taste of what the book sounds and feels like. I think that'd be really nice.
Yeah, that's great. I'll read a very short excerpt right from the beginning of the book, when Jeanette is appearing at an academic conference and trying to explain her work to people who don't appear to be very interested in it. Jeanette may as well be invisible. She's standing on the stage in the auditorium in front of about 200 other astronomers, presenting the results of her PhD work at the annual British conference, but she can tell no one's listening. She doesn't blame them. She wouldn't listen either if she didn't have to. If she could only find a way of drowning out that slightly tremulous voice in her head, which is going on and on about dust in early galaxies. Still, not long now. She's reached the final slide, showing the actual data. That may interest them more. She shines the red dot of the laser pointer onto the screen, wishing it didn't betray her nervousness. She's trying to show them the centre of a galaxy, the point where the contours on the map converge into the peak of intensity, and the dot is dancing round it, refusing to settle down. Perhaps it doesn't matter. She's only just finished her thesis. She's expected to be young and overawed by the prospect of speaking at a conference. But they're not interested in this slide either. Some of them are working on their laptops. Others are talking to each other. Several people are fiddling with their phones, reading the conference programme, even reading newspapers. Her boss, the Death Star, is asleep. That's to be expected. He always sits in the front row and sleeps, only waking up at the end to ask some horribly pertinent question. She wonders what he'll ask today, because it's not enough to give the talk in a whisper and be ignored. The experience isn't complete without the ritual of questions afterwards, to allow the mostly male audience to do the verbal equivalent of showing their tail feathers off to each other. She gets to the end, clicks off the laser, stands and waits. She doesn't have to wait long. The Death Star wakes up and stares at her as if he's never seen her before. "What does it mean?" he asks, before his eyes snap shut again, not bothering to wait for her reply. What does it mean? It means what she's already explained to him and everyone else, that the peak of infrared emission from this galaxy is spatially offset from the peak at visible wavelengths, implying a large amount of dust must be present, which is obscuring some of the stars, soaking up their light, and re-emitting it at longer wavelengths. The dust is made by exploding stars come to the end of their lives. So this is an old galaxy. It's already produced at least one generation of stars. Interesting enough, if you want to know the detail of how galaxies work. It means she has fulfilled the obligations of her PhD and carried out a suitably non-controversial, i.e. boring, project, proved herself capable of slogging away at a telescope, night after night to gather data of dubious quality, writing software not obviously riddled with errors to reduce and analyse the data, and then copied the style of thousands of other equally boring academic papers to report what she has discovered, so that she can get a job and carry on doing this for the rest of her life, if she's lucky. This is what it means right now. She knows that it means other things too. It means she has escaped. Escaped from home, the depression in the sofa, the radioactive glow of the TV, the outer space vacuum in the house, and the cigarette ash sprinkled over everything like earth on the coffin.
Pippa Goldschmidt, everybody. Her book, The Falling Sky, is out from Freight Books right now. Go out, get it, read it, and if you like it, don't forget you can vote for it at the Edinburgh International Book Festival's webpage under their first book award. And actually, we should say, if you're interested in the Scottish Book Trust New Writers Award, you can apply now. The applications are open on the Scottish Book Trust website. The deadline is the 20th of September. Check out all the details on our website. Our next guest, Naomi Alderman, was featured as one of Granta's best young British novelists, and she doesn't just write novels. She was recently up in Edinburgh talking with Margaret Atwood about writing for different mediums, different art forms. She's written video games, she's written Doctor Who novels, and she's also got her own fantastic body of work, and she's currently at work on a new novel herself. What we're about to hear is Naomi. She was involved in a great collaboration with The Moss Project, which is a jazz band. She basically wrote a story based on a jazz song. And Naomi is here, and she's going to explain this whole endeavor to you.
Hello, I'm Naomi Alderman. I wrote a short story which accompanied one of the tracks on the album made by The Moss Project called What Do You See When You Close Your Eyes?
We're going to get to hear the track after we hear your story, but can you tell us a little bit about the process that involved, like, responding to jazz?
Sure. So I sat in a library with very good headphones that don't let sound out and listened to this track over and over again until something just came through my fingers into the laptop, like a bit like Victorian seances, automatic writing, something crystallizing out of the air from the music. So I have as little idea as anybody else what my story means.
Seriously, you have no idea?
No, well, now that I've sat with it for about a year, I suddenly go, oh, it's about that thing that is a concern of mine. But I didn't know it when I was writing it. It just popped out from this music. It just sort of emerged.
Did you try really hard to like empty your mind? Did you go into like a zen-like state and just be like, okay, I'm not going to think about my problems with so-and-so or my dog's died or whatever. I'm just going to think about jazz and notes.
Jazz. Yeah. I mean, kind of. I don't really know a lot about jazz, but I tried to just be there with the music and see what happened. And Moss's music, I think, I think his music is wonderful, and it has that interesting effect on the inside of my brain of just going, makes interesting things happen, it makes interesting connections happen. There's something about maybe this music or maybe jazz, which you don't get caught into a sort of a rut of just being hypnotized by it. It startles your brain, and so you come up with interesting new things.
Had you done stuff like this before?
I've certainly listened to music whilst I'm writing novels.
Okay, I thought you were going to stop there. I've certainly listened to music before.
Yes, I've certainly heard some music before. Have you?
It's good to know you're not a cyborg.
I think cyborgs listen to music, but listen, if I were a cyborg, I would still deserve equal rights. And there are particular scenes in some of my novels which will forever be associated with pieces of music to me. There's a Sibelius piece which I just listened to over and over again whilst working on my second novel, The Lessons. And it really, there's a chapter which is just all Sibelius, which really has infected that chapter for me. There's a chapter which is just all about that music. But this is the first time a musician had asked me to respond to the work. And the first time that I specifically set out to do that. My new novel is out in paperback right now. It's called The Liar's Gospel. It is a book about Jesus, told in the form of four alternate gospels of characters who don't get a gospel in the original. But it doesn't respond to any music.
Yeah. But you can listen to music while you're reading it.
Certainly, I certainly haven't put anything into the book that would stop you doing that. Any sort of dampening, sound dampening fields or anything.
Naomi Alderman, here's her story now from The Moss Project.
There's a bubble inside her, like a balloon, about that big, a child's multicoloured balloon. But not a balloon, a bubble, right in the centre of her body, somewhere between womb and stomach. It's an ordinary bubble, made of soap or some such, thinner than thin, swirling rainbow filament skin. It's the thing that keeps her so light. When she's walking along the street, she can feel the bubble. It's the thing that makes her feet not quite touch the ground, the engine that keeps the colours moving inside her head. There they go. Every jangle of keys, every shout of passerby, every roar of a car, every ugly thing turns into those moving rainbows, and so it's perfectly all right. A motorbike shrieks to a halt to avoid a pedestrian, and the sound of it is red velvet streamers fluttering in the breeze. Shopping falls to the floor, and the crunch of broken glass is blue ice crystals sparkling. The angry man swears, but bright yellow gerberas stream from his lips, rising up into the air, so she's fine, she's just fine. The thought crosses her mind that at some point this bubble inside her abdomen, somewhere between womb and stomach, is likely to burst. That's what bubbles do, after all. They can't last forever. And then where will she be? There's a kind of danger there, roaring and violent, something right there in the centre of her body, something that happened. The bubble says, don't think about it. Listen to the music playing in your head. Stay light, float away, don't come back down. Some other part of her, very far away, says, you'll have to come back in the end. This music can't last forever. Don't you remember the wires? That knotted self, the various kinds of damage you have already caused to yourself. Don't you remember what's happened? No, says the bubble. No, no, no. Everything is fine. Nothing has gone wrong in either my womb or my stomach. I haven't lost anything, and I certainly didn't make it happen myself. Yes, she thinks. That's right. I'm light. So very light. Look at the sky, so full of clouds, each one pearlescent pink, or glass green, or bottle blue, or vivid violet. Look at the sky. Float up to it on that bubble. Don't look down. But the day
That was The Bubble by The Moss Project, and thanks again to Naomi Alderman for sharing that great story with us. We were really happy to have that featured on the podcast. And everybody, go check out The Moss Project. You can find their work online, get the album. They worked with a load of other writers as part of this project at the London Literature Festival. It's all really, really good stuff. You can find it online. That's it for this episode, everybody. Thanks again to Helen Fitzgerald, Pippa Goldschmidt, Naomi Alderman, and, of course, The Moss Project. If you want to find out more about the New Writers Award, find out more book recommendations, or just read about writing, you can check out the Scottish Book Trust website, scottishbooktrust.com. Don't forget, you can also follow us on Twitter and ask us questions at @ScottishBKTrust. Or, of course, simply like us on Facebook, and we'll show up in your news feed. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do subscribe via iTunes. Just click the link and we'll have a new episode in your iTunes every 2 weeks. It's been really fun hosting in this episode. We'll see you very, very soon. Book Talked is produced by Colin Fraser with music from Ragland.